This is the first class of four classes that we'll do on Chapter 8 of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Bodhicharya Avatara. I've entitled this Learning to Identify with Others, which kind of gives away the real centerpiece of this chapter. Tonight, we're going to do 88 verses. Obviously not slowly. So, I mean, that's just the way it is. I've structured, you know, all of these Middle Way Center courses into four classes, and it just so happens that chapters 8 and 9 of the Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life are among the longest chapters. Chapter 8 is, I don't know, 170, 80 verses or something, and so we just have to do our best. And chapter 9 is also a very long chapter, and in addition is the hardest chapter. So the bar gets raised or lowered or raised, I think. So this is the chapter on dhyana, the perfection of dhyana, meditation. And as I said, I think the last time we met, it's not really a how to meditate, sort of handbook, but it goes through, number one, the prerequisites for living a meditative lifestyle. The prerequisites. And then it talks about the objects of meditation, the object of meditation, really. There's several different permutations on that object. And the method for how to meditate on the objects of meditation that Shantideva lays out in this chapter. And then it ends with the benefits of meditation. So tonight we'll hit the first part of that, the prerequisites for meditation. So without kind of further ado, we better move ahead since we're going to do 88 verses. Everyone have a hand up? Okay, good. Having thus fortified one's perseverance, so this is, you know, following the chapter on virya, on, you know, joyful effort. Having thus fortified one's perseverance, one should establish the mind in meditative integration. And that's a translation for samadhi, which has almost become an English word now. But there's a lot of different understandings of what samadhi means, and that's also in the original text. Depending on what text you go to, you get a different kind of understanding and definition of what samadhi means. But this is a fairly literal translation into English of the Sanskrit meaning of the term. It means to integrate, to put together, samadhi, to put together. So what are you integrating with? And, you know, one short answer to that is the purpose of meditation is to integrate with reality. It's to integrate with how things are. To merge your mind with how things are. So I kind of like this translation. It's a little, you know, clumsy, meditative integration. You know, there's a lot of syllables. But, you know, that's the reason I translated it like that. One should establish the mind in meditative integration, for a person whose mind is distracted lives within the jaws of the mental afflictions. Anyone unclear on that? If you're not, like, paying attention, if you don't have a mind that's not distracted, that's not completely, like, scattered all the time, you're just at the mercy of whatever new mental affliction arises, and they do arise regularly. Moment to moment. Mental affliction, for those of you who don't know, means anything that disturbs your peace of mind, literally. So, you know, all of the negative emotions, anger, jealousy, envy, pride, etc., and all smaller versions thereof. You know, so that's the purpose of meditation. He says it right here in the very start. The purpose of meditation is to be able to keep your mind undistracted, so that you're not just living in the jaws of mental afflictions. Distraction does not arise when the body and mind are kept secluded. Viveka. Viveka is a very important word in a lot of texts in Sanskrit. It means isolated, really. So you're keeping your mind and body isolated from sense objects, from the objects of the senses and the senses that are perceiving the sense objects and are intrigued with the sense objects all the time. So you keep your sort of distance from the unfoldings, the constant unfoldings of these distractions. Distraction does not arise when the body and mind are kept secluded, and so one should renounce the world and turn away from intellectual disputations. He's going to talk a lot about renouncing the world in the next, 80 verses or so. But he doesn't come back to this second thing very much, so I'll just say a few words about it. Away from intellectual disputations. Always arguing with each other about the Dharma. Always arguing each other with about philosophy, about, politics or something like that. And that is a major kind of distraction. A major distraction to a meditative mindset. To a mindset that's, kind of characterized by peace. You see? So, it's good to, think things through and to be analytical and to, kind of weigh things up and judge things up. But there's got to come to an end to that. At a certain point, you just got to, draw an end to it and say, okay, if you believe something else, that's fine. Here's what I've come to, the conclusions that I've come to, and then move ahead with it and stop, just spinning your wheels all the time. Talking, arguing. One does not renounce the world. So now he's going to talk about renunciation quite a bit here. As a precondition to meditation. So just, it's like in the yoga texts where they say pratyahara, withdrawing the senses in order for there to be dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. There first has to be a kind of a turning away from the constant distractions of the senses. And of course, Shantideva had no idea the kind of distractions that we're, kind of faced with in the modern world. Unbelievable. And not just the modern world, in the last 20 years, the distraction level has gone up exponentially. With the invention of the internet. Okay, forget about it, Had no idea. I was wonder, what kind of distractions is he talking about in, 8th century India? Oh my God, there goes an ox cart. how much distraction could there be in village life in ancient India? But here? Forget about it. One does not renounce the world due to attachment and because of craving for acquisitions and the like. Labha adi. Labha means acquisitions. Adi means and all the rest. Craving. So this is a Buddhist text. And, trishna. Trishna is the reason why we suffer according to the Four Noble Truths. We suffer because we're always wanting something else. We always want something more, something different. So due to attachment, due to grasping onto the objects of the senses, and then the craving for more and more and more and more, more all the time. That's why we don't turn about. Renouncing the world here, as you'll see, kind of means literally. In Shantideva's presentation, it means, getting the hell out and going to the forest or the jungle or to the ashram or to the monastery. So that's, not relevant, I think, for any of us much here. So we have to think about how to, kind of translate that into our own terms. And, renouncing the world, doesn't, for us, doesn't mean physically leaving social life. But it means gaining some detachment from it and some appreciation for solitude, for peace and quiet. And, this is another long rant, and I have 88 verses to do, so I'm not going to go on a long rant about it. But this is the challenge of our age. This is the challenge for each and every one of us, is to fight the power. And the power is enormous. The power that keeps us busy all the time, occupied all the time, distracted all the time. Surfing the internet, answering the email, texting, and let alone just interacting personally, you see. So we all have to kind of find some survival techniques on how to regain solitude in our lives. So, you might kind of translate all of this renunciation stuff into that kind of language. How are we going to find peace and quiet in the world? In the world that we live in, you see. And, here's one quick advice on this. Turn it off. turn it off. You know, turn off the computer, turn off the handheld, turn off the television, turn off the radio, turn off all the electronic gadgets. And all of a sudden, it's just you. Just you and your mind. Or in your, you know, probably the, you know, kids and the wife and the husband, and you know. So then you go into another room. Therefore, a person in the know would consider this when renouncing it. So you consider what it is that you're renouncing, really. And he says in the first sentence there, you're renouncing attachments and craving. You're renouncing this kind of addiction to the sensual stimulus. Knowing that one who has become thoroughly familiar with the discernment, this is a translation of vipassana. For those of you who know, vipassana in Pali. I translate it as discernment, the ability to distinguish one thing from another. Pash means to see, and the V prefix means, you know, kind of, you know, multiple way, to see things differently, to be able to distinguish things. What to give up and what to take up, for example. What's good for you and what isn't good for you. What's true and what's false, like that. Knowing that one who has become thoroughly familiar with the discernment that comes from mental tranquility, shamatha. Shamatha means peace of mind. So he's saying here, the ability to discern properly, the ability to use your head properly, comes from first having calm, getting some calm, getting some peace of mind. Knowing that one who has become thoroughly familiar with the discernment that comes from mental tranquility destroys the mental afflictions, one should first seek mental tranquility, shamatha. So how do we get peace of mind? And the rest of the chapter, I mean, at least the first, you know, long segment here is how to get some peace of mind. How to get some peace of mind as a prerequisite for how to gain meditative focus. You can't get focus while your mind is, you know, a monkey on speed, jumping around here and there, you see. And it comes, and so what, and how, and what does mental tranquility come from? Shamatha. It comes from joyful indifference to the world. That's a very nice phrase. It's not just I don't care about the world, or, you know, the world sucks or something like that. Joyful detachment. Lucid dreaming, yeah? Joyful detachment, not getting sucked in. Among those who are impermanent. So now he's going to talk about attachment a little bit. So attachment to people, of course, is one major attachment that we have to others. Among those who are impermanent, and you can all raise your hand as to who's impermanent here. There are no exceptions to that, okay? There's no permanent people in here. I don't see anyone. Anitya. Among those who are impermanent, those who will not see their loved ones again for thousands of lifetimes. Who is worthy of the attachment of an impermanent person? See, we're all just passing through here. It's all just, we're all tourists in the world. You know, just passing through. In our lives. Just tourists in our lives. And everyone in our lives is just passing through too. And so it's all just, you know, kind of flux. It's all in flux, all just impermanence. So what's the point of getting attached? What's the point of trying? Attachment means grasping to an impermanent thing, hoping that it'll stay the same. Hoping that it'll somehow become permanent by you grasping onto it. But it's really just like grasping onto feathers, you know. You can't catch anything. It's all just in flux. By the way, I mean, tonight's hardcore, okay? I mean, it's every night will be hardcore in a different way. But this is hardcore when it comes to our attachments. When it comes to, you know, people who have a romantic sensibility is going to hate this class, okay? I'll tell you that right now. Not seeing them, not seeing your loved ones, brings no pleasure. You have a loved one, you're not seeing them, you miss them. And one does not abide in meditative integration because, you know, you're pining to see, you know, the loved one that you're missing. even when one does see them, it brings no satisfaction. I mean, kind of as we know, right? You miss somebody for a long, long time, and then finally you get back together and you're like, oh, it's you. Because what you're really longing for is not the person. It's the ideal of the person. See, and then real people actually talk back and stuff, and, you know, do irritating things, and then you go, oh, you know. Yeah, that's not the one I was missing. The one I was longing for and missing was just my ideal of that person, and then the real person comes in, and, you know, that's not happy either. And just as before, one is tormented by longing. Longing for the ideal instead of for the real person. You see? That's very clever. One does not see things as they are. Yatha Bhuta. As they exist. And because... So how do things exist? I mean, how do people exist? They exist as impermanent. And they also exist kind of like in ways that escape your fantasies of how they should exist. You see, they don't live up to your fantasies. They don't live up to your ideals. So that's how they really exist. They really exist as, you know, out of your control. Out of the control of your imagination. One does not see things as they are. And because of this agitation, the agitation that occurs between how you think things should be and how they really are, that person's left high and dry. You know that expression? High and dry. You know, kind of hopeless. He or she is consumed with the grief that comes from wishing to be with loved ones. Because of obsessing about this, this short life slips by moment, and is lived in vain. Because of transient things, one is deprived of the eternal Dharma. It's a very clever, he's a very good Sanskritist, very good writer. Ashashvatena means not permanent, transient. Dharmena, Dharma means many different things. It can mean things, so that's how I translated it here. So because of transient things, dharmo brashyati shashvata. So he's using the same word dharma here for things and then for dharma with the capital D, dharma, teachings. Has that connotation. And then playing around with this shashvata, ashashvata. Because of transient things, one is deprived of the eternal dharma, the dharma that doesn't change. Acting like the spiritually immature. Bala means child in Sanskrit. And it's a word that he uses quite a bit in the following verses. So what he means here is people who don't kind of have a clue when it comes to the spiritual life. And he's got some things to say about them. Acting like the spiritual immature, one inevitably falls into a bad place. Durgati usually means a bad rebirth. But I've kind of fudged it a little bit, so people who don't believe in rebirth don't have to deal with that. Acting like the spiritually immature, one inevitably falls into a bad place, and one does not try to be different. Doesn't try to improve themselves. What is there to gain from association with the spiritually immature? So, you know, he's talking about renunciation. Talking about renunciation of, you know, loved ones, and he'll come back to that. Especially... objects of sexual desire. You'll come back to that in a big way. That's why I said, like, all romantics better brace themselves here. But so now he's talking about hanging around with bad company, really. Hanging around with people who aren't interested in the Dharma, aren't interested in a moral life, aren't interested in coming to retreats, aren't interested in going to yoga studios. They just, you know, they have... And there are a lot of people like that nowadays, aren't there? So he said, be careful. Be careful about who you're hanging out with. What results from this? What is there to gain from association with spiritually immature? One moment they're friends and the next moment they're enemies. Ever had that happen to you? When in a place where they should be content, they're stressed out. Ordinary people, he says, are hard to please. Good advice enrages them, and they try to turn me away from it. And yet, if they're not listened to, they get angry at others and fall into a bad place. Envious of the eminent. Envious of people who have more fame than they do. Competitive with equals. proud in relation to inferiors, arrogant when praised, and enraged when criticized. When does anything good come from hanging around with the spiritually immature? So this is, I mean, you know, there's one more here, I guess. Elevating oneself and putting down others. Chatting about the pleasures of the cycle of suffering. Chatting about how awesome samsara is. Which usually means, like, gossiping about other people's problems. You know, how interesting it is that so-and-so is getting divorced and all of that, you know. It's suffering. It's just suffering. And then people take interest and even pleasure in suffering. And so, and such unpleasantness is inevitable when the spiritually immature get together. And so it is that because of such associations, one encounters what is anartha, completely useless. No point to it. Then he says, there's the cash out. I will dwell happily alone with an unafflicted mind. I'm out of here. I'm no longer going to hang out with, you know, with this sort of crowd. So here's the first time that he, you know, kind of emphasizes the importance of being alone. And being alone, by the way, is different than being lonely. You see? Being lonely is being unhappy being alone. Right? And if you're unhappy being alone, who are you unhappy being with? Right? So it's a little bit of a litmus test as to, you know, how much of a friend you are to yourself. Is how much, you know, how much can you tolerate being with yourself? And that means also not just with other people, but being with yourself without the distractions of the internet, of the Facebook, of the, you know, emails, et cetera, which all always take us out of ourselves, right? Always distract us from ourselves. I will dwell happily alone with the unafflicted mind. So now he begins to talk about the advantages of solitary living. And again, you know, this is not really, you know, kind of literally practical for most, if not all of us. But, you know, again, my advice is to take these verses and think, well, how can I get more solitude in the life that I'm living now? More peace and quiet. And peace and quiet means solitude. So that means not just the solitude that you get by turning things off, but also finding time to be alone. And anyone can do this. I know there's several people here, many people maybe, who are in family situations or living with a partner or something like that. But there's always ways to get around that, you know. Let the husband take care of the kids for a while. Or let the wife take care of the kids for a while. Or the husband and wife or boyfriend or girlfriend or something like that can find time to spend on their own. And actually, that's a much healthier way to conduct a relationship, actually, is to, you know, allow the other person to have their time alone and to actually encourage it and to, you know, to support it in various kinds of ways. And then they come back happy, a lot happier. You know, they've been away from you for a while anyway. That's already a good thing. One should keep one's distance from the spiritually immature, and when one encounters them, one should placate them with endearments. You know, they should like, oh, you know, it's so good to see you again, so good to see you. Oh, I gotta go. Because the next thing he says is, not with the intention of becoming intimate, but rather with the uninvolvement of a holy man, sadhu. So you encounter these people, and you're nice to them and all like that, and then you get the hell out. Shanti Davis, you know, he doesn't like kind of make any bones about a lot of things. You know, he just tells it like it is a lot. Taking only what is useful for the Dharma, like a bee taking honey from a flower, I will always dwell unpraised and as if I had no past. So that's kind of interesting. I mean, it's hard to figure out sometimes why he says what he says. So, you know, it's kind of a little bit of guesswork. Why is he bringing up this thing about being unpraised at this juncture in the text? Well, maybe he's suggesting that the associations that we have with others, especially what he's calling the spiritually immature, is really just to enhance our ego. is really just to kind of, you know, hope that other people will boost our ego by, you know, saying like how cool we are or how, you know, great it is to be around you and this and that. And then as if I had no past, which means living in the moment, you know, living in the present. And that's a whole other story. A mortal who thinks, I am rich and honored and many people like me, lives in fear of approaching death. The more attachments that you have, the more fearful you are of losing them. And the big loss is death. And you know, by the way, just as an aside, you know, if you are helping someone die, you know, a loved one who is passing on, the best thing that you can do for them is to help them detach. Because they can't take it with them, you see? Detach from you also. And so, like, you know, we love you and all like that, but we'll be okay. We'll be okay, you know. We'll miss you, but we'll be all right, you know. Because culturally, there's in many, many cultures, there's this kind of notion that it's really a great thing to do to start, like, screaming and crying and, oh, we'll miss you. And, you know, they even, like, hire out people to do this in some cultures. In Greece, I think, they have mourners, you know, professional mourners. This is not helping the person who's dying at all, you see. Because, you know, they can't stay. You can sit around and cry all you want, they can't stay. So, you know, this kind of like, this kind of attachment, this kind of grasping is guaranteed to cause suffering. Because you will lose it. You will lose it. Where am I? Oh, yeah. So I am rich and honored. So, you know, he mentions this a couple of times in the text. The grasping to money, prosperity, and the grasping to fame. These are the two big, you know, graspings. They live in fear of approaching death. Wherever the mind, infatuated with pleasure, seeks delight, it finds there only suffering, multiplied 1,000 times. There's another verse earlier on in the text where he says, the sensual pleasures are like licking honey off a razor blade. They taste good initially, and then you realize that your tongue is bleeding. You know, for one thing, we always want more of them. As soon as you get one thing, you want another, you know? Food is an excellent example of this. You have a nice dinner. You know, the food's here is good, isn't it? It's pretty good. And then, like, 2 hours later, you're hungry again. You know? I have a little snack now, you know? Over and over and over, you just want more and more and more. Never satisfied. Wherever the mind, infatuated with pleasure, seeks delight, it finds there only suffering. And so a wise person does not wish for it. A wise person is content. There's no discontent wise people. You know? That's kind of one of the features of wisdom. Is that, you know, they're fine. People are fine with what comes their way, and not always wanting more. A wise person does not wish for it. Yearning gives birth to fear. Yearning's another, you know, ichata is another word for kama or desire. A lot of different words for desire. Desire gives birth to fear, and yet it goes away on its own. How does desire go away on its own? If you don't empower it, if you don't identify with it, if you don't say, I want, if you just say, wanting is happening, it lasts for, like all mental afflictions, okay? This is the case with all mental afflictions. Anger, desire, jealousy, they arise for a while, they last for a while, and if you don't infuse them with ego, they just dissipate, just like everything else. Just comes and goes. So it goes away on its own in a way, unless you attach to it. Unless you say, I am angry. I am desirous. I am jealousy. Unless you know, give it the weight of the imaginary ego. Put the fuel of the ego behind it. They just come and go, just like any other emotion. Like, you know, if you want to do an exercise, a very famous kind of exercise is just watch. Just watch your mind, you know. Just watch it. Don't take action. Don't take any action, but just watch. And you see, it just comes and goes. Goes on its own. You don't have to do anything. You just have to stop identifying with it. You know, stop empowering it. So regard it with fortitude. Many have become rich and famous, but who knows where they've gone with their wealth and fame? Can't take it with you? Heard that expression before? You know, I think we all have some kind of inner pharaoh. You know, pharaoh, P-H-A-R-A-O-H? You know, the ancient Egyptian rulers who, when they died, they threw all their stuff in them with them, you know? All their possessions got into the grave, and they, I think people too, you know, the wives probably got offed and put in there too, and, you know, because they were all going to like go to Never Never Land together somehow. And I think like we all have this idea that somehow, like, you know, we know better at a certain level, but you know, subconsciously maybe we think, well, you know, it's all going to be worth it somehow. I've got all of this money, I've got this property, I've got this great family, I've got this wonderful boyfriend, girlfriend, and it's all going to lose you. Lose it all. Absolutely lose it all. Can't take it with you at all. Many become rich and famous, but where's their richness and famous now? Where are they now even? You see? Gone. When others revile me, why do I rejoice when I'm praised? When others praise me, why am I dejected when I'm defamed? Some people will like you, some people won't like you. That's... Okay, you can put that up on your refrigerator. In life, some people just aren't going to like you. And they will defame you. And you can, like, think that that's unfair and, you know, get all hot and bothered about it and maybe even, like, try to, you know, beg them to like you or something. They're still not going to like you. And then some people will like you, you know, no matter what. You know, you could be a real jerk and they're still going to like you somehow. You know, so that's just the way it is. It's, you know, it's don't get so attached to it. You know, I used to hear that according to some, you know, scripture or another, a third of the people in the world that you encounter will like you, a third of the people won't like you, and a third of the people won't care about you. Neutral. And I think that works out about right. That's about the percentage. That's about it. Living beings of all sorts are not made to be satisfied, even by the conquerors. You see, even the Buddhas can't satisfy people. We're just so, like, retarded. We're just so hard cases that nobody. So what about me? How then, by ignorant people like me? Well, you know, what's the point of spending your whole life trying to make everyone like you all the time? Even the Buddhas can't make everybody like them. So what's the point of such worldly thinking? They revile the poor and dump on the rich. That's modern culture right there. You know? They sort of like look down at poor people and then like envy rich people. And then dump on them means like, you know, blame them for all their problems. Oh, it's all the 1%. You know? What was that thing, that movement a couple of years ago? The Occupy Everything? And it was always the 1% that were, you know, that were to blame for all our problems. You know? How can there be enjoyment among those who by nature have linked themselves to suffering? The Buddhists have said that a spiritually immature person is no one's friend, for his or her affection is never without self-interest. And then he's very interesting here. Affection motivated by self-interest is only affection for the self. So if you're like another person in the because you want them to like you, it's about liking you that you like the other person. Only affection for the self. And is like the anxiety that comes from the loss of happiness when one loses one's possessions. So that's one sort of segment of the text. Now he goes into how awesome it would be to be alone. Being with other people is such a mess. It's just such a drag. You know, I was wondered, like, you know, you always wonder about the authors of texts like this. Shantideva reputedly was a monk. You know, he lived in a monastery. And I've been to an Indian, to a Tibetan Buddhist monastery transported into India. And those places are nightmares. I mean, people live right on top of each other. You can hear everything. You know, they're all guys. I mean, maybe nunneries are better. But they're all guys. They're all just, you know, spitting and hawking and farting. You know, just, you know, like, it's like a big, you know, ugly fraternity with robes. And so you imagine, like, if you spent, like, long, long years in a monastery like this, you know, you just go, God, it's driving me nuts, these people. So he goes on to this reverie about how awesome it would be to get the hell out of here. Trees do not make efforts to condemn or praise. Oh, and by the way, lots of backbiting and stuff like that, too, in the monasteries. Lots of, you know, fighting and quarrels and this and that. She says, trees don't bug anybody. Trees do not make efforts to condemn or praise. When will I make my home among such pleasant companions? When will I retire, never looking back, and stay in an empty temple, or at the foot of a tree, or in a cave? When will I dwell in expansive natural places owned by no one, residing wherever I want? When will I live without fear, my body unguarded, my clothes repugnant for the thieves? To have nothing that anyone wants. So no fear, you know, no fear of getting ripped off because you don't have anything. The entirety of possessions consisting of a clay begging bowl. When will so that's a little reverie. Then he's going to get pretty gnarly here. Okay, you ready? Because he's going to talk about the major attachment that we have. Okay, bar none. Never mind riches and fame. The attachment to the physical body is the biggest attachment that we have. The attachment to the physical body. I think I can safely say that. If there's anyone who wants to debate that, we can go climb up to the roof of a building and dangle you from your ankles and see whether or not you have any attachment to your physical body. When will I visit cremation grounds and compare my own decaying body with the corpses of others? This is what your body will look like soon enough. Just check it out. Go, you know, in India, even today, in places like Banaras, you know, the bodies are right there. You know, you go to the grounds and you can see them, and, you know, before they start crackling and popping and, you know, in the fire. You know, just sitting there. And, you know, in the old days, even now I think in some places they just expose them to the vultures. What's that? Parsis, I think, do that. Yeah. Yeah, and you say just sitting there for days and weeks and all like that until the vultures all pick them all off. So you say, well, you know, go to a place like that. If you're attached to your body, you might want to visit a place like that. When will I visit cremation grounds and compare my own decaying body with the corpses of others? Come on. This body of mine will become so putrid that even the jackals won't come near it due to the stench. The attachment to the body takes a lot of imagination. If you actually, like, look at it, if you actually look at what this is, it is not a pure thing. It is not a pleasant thing. And, you know, so he's got some pretty radical, you know, methods for how to get over this attachment, like hanging out in, you know, graveyards and cremation grounds and stuff like that. But, you know, you don't have to go to that length. You just have to, like, be realistic. The older you get, the harder it is to be attached to your body. I'll tell you that right now. Because it just lets you down regularly. Isn't it? I mean, it's just like constantly problems. There's constant problems. You know, and when you're younger, you think, well, you have a problem once in a while, and then it goes away, and then, well, I'll never have one again somehow. You know, gosh, I had a sore neck a while ago. Yeah, never mind about that. The older you get, the body just crumbles. It just goes. And then, you know, when it starts going, nobody else, you know, kind of really wants to know about that. You know, especially when it really goes, when you can't control your bowels and, you know, right? Like, nobody wants to hang out with somebody who just stinks and, you know, you have to clean them out, they're bleeding and they're vomiting. That's what illness is, right? Illness is just having everything that was once inside come out. It's always been in there. You know, the excrement, the vomit, the blood, but as long as this all stays in there, you know, then somehow we can imagine that, oh, you know, it's okay, everything's so, oh, look, I'm beautiful. I do yoga. The fragments of bone that arise together with my unified body will disintegrate piece by piece, just as they will with other beloved people. Everybody's body's like that. A person, you know, this is Shantideva at his most harsh, okay? But true. A person is born alone and dies alone. A person is born alone and dies alone. And those of you who know, like, list Buddhism, you know, there's all kinds of lists in Buddhism, know that this is one of the six sufferings. There's, you know, the three sufferings and the 8, 10 sufferings. And the first one of the six sufferings is that you're alone. That you're alone. Nobody knows you. Inside, you know, you as the individual, you as a person, nobody really knows you. You know, and we try our best to try to overcome that. That's why we, you know, make friends. That's why we take lovers. That's why we, you know, have children in a way. That's why we have dogs. That's why we have pets. Is that, well, maybe my pet will know me, you know. But nobody really knows you. Nobody knows what goes on inside there, right? And so you're born alone and you die alone. No one else shares in your pain. You know, your loved ones sort of seem like they share in your pain, but really, you know, it's just you. Nobody really knows what it feels like to suffer, except for you. No one knows how you feel when you suffer, except for you. What use is there in loved ones who function as obstacles? I told you, not a romantic, okay? This guy's not buying Hallmark Valentine's Day cards or anything like that. Just as someone who is on a journey takes temporary lodging, so too does one traveling through existence take lodging in a rebirth. It's just passing through. The body is just like a hotel room, motel room. So you just rent it for a while. And then you go. Then you go to another motel room, maybe. As long as the four men refer to the pallbearers, pallbearers, the four guys who are going to carry your casket. As long as the four men have not yet taken you and you are mourned by the world, you should withdraw to the forest. Before you should die to the world before you die. Die to the world before you die. In the Hindu system, we were talking with Charu and Ramesh about this. In the Hindu system, they have what they call the ashramas, the four stages of life. And so the first stage of life is called the student stage, brahmacharya, where, you know, you're young and you're learning stuff and all like that. Then comes householder stage. That's when you know, get married and have kids and get a mortgage. Then there's called vanaprastha. Vanaprastha is the kind of transitional stage. So traditionally that would begin when you saw your first grandchild, when your children have children. Then you start to, like, you know, withdraw from the world, die to the world. And that ends with sannyas. Sannyasa is a ritual death. You perform your own death ceremony, and then you go as nobody, you know, as a complete non-entity, you know, into the forest or the ashram or wherever it is that you're going. It's thought to be so death-like that if you came back after sannyas, it would be like seeing a ghost. People would regard you as like a ghost coming back to haunt them. So he's talking about that kind of thing. Of dying to the world before you actually die. I mean, you will die. So at a certain point, he's saying, like, you know, start start preparing for that in a way, right? Start detaching from that which you cannot keep. Without either intimacy or hostility, one should live in physical solitude. Already dead to the world, one does not grieve when dying. So, you know, life is a practice for death. And most of us don't live like that at all. We don't think that life is a practice for death because we don't think death is actually going to reach us somehow. So we think that, you know, life is just for living itself, you know. But everybody who has a birthday will have a death day. If you are born, you will die. And so, you know, he's suggesting here that, you know, you spend at least some of the time that you are living as if you were dying, as if you were dead, actually, as if you weren't entangled in the, you know, social world, in the family world, in the economic world, in the political world, and all of that. There is no one around to bring grief or pain. So now he starts again extolling the virtues of physical solitude. There's no one around to bring grief or pain. No one around to bug me because it's just me. Of course, if you actually do go into solitary retreat, you'll find somebody who will bug you, all right. You know who it's going to be? You. But at least you don't have other people to blame. Actually, you probably do blame other people too. It's memories of other people that then, you know, disturb your peace of mind, you know. But he's saying, like, you know, at least it's just, you know, you in your own mind. And so may I, in solitude, there's no one around to bring grief or pain, and no one at all to dissipate one's recollection of the Buddha, and so forth. So again, no distractions. To sort of cut loose on the distractions so that you can remember your, you know, your spiritual goals. And so may I, in solitude, always frequent such enjoyable, relaxing, peaceful places where all distractions are pacified. And again, you know, this is Shantideva doing the hardcore, you know, ancient India thing of like really retiring from the world, really renouncing the world. So what version of that can we incorporate into our lives, you see? How can we find a little more peace and quiet in our own lives? Here's another suggestion on that. First suggestion is turn things off. Turn things off for at least like an hour or two a day, you know? Especially good in the morning, so that you're starting your morning like, you know, fresh and, you know, at peace. Take a day off a week. Take a, what do they call it now, Cindy? What was that expression that I heard? Digital detox. Digital detox. So one day a week, nothing on. Every day, you know, hour or two, nothing on. One day a week. This is an ancient religious practice. Honor the Sabbath. So it's in the Ten Commandments, for those of you who know, you know, the Judeo-Christian tradition. Honor the Sabbath and keep it holy, or something like that. Which Sabbath means you don't work. And, you know, that means kind of like, nowadays it means that you're not in communication. Because mostly what we're in communication with is people that are involved in one way or another in our work. You know, in our enterprises or whatever it is. And you take a holiday, okay? Here's another suggestion. Couple of weeks a year where you don't do anything. That's called vacation. Remember vacation? Yeah. Well, we live in Australia, so a lot of people in Australia remember vacation. The whole place is on vacation, like almost all the time. They just, any excuse for a holiday. But I think that's not the case in a lot of places in the world anymore. You know, I know in America, many people just don't go on holiday anymore. They're too afraid, for one thing. They're too afraid that, you know, they'll fall behind on the job or somebody else will get ahead of them. They're turning back their paid vacation days, which are already minimal. The U.S., I think, a good job, you get 2 weeks paid. A good job. In Europe, it's more like 5 or 6 weeks paid, you know, kind of regularly. And, you know, but still. So plan it as part of your spiritual practice, you see, as part of your spiritual, you know, endeavor. Take time off so that you're restored. You know, and that also means time off from, you know, whatever kind of yoga you're doing or meditation or like that. Take time off from that too. People can get as attached to that as work as anything else, you see. Yeah. So that's one way to understand all this kind of stuff he's going to say about how awesome it would be to live in the jungle, you know, all by myself. And so may I in solitude always frequent such enjoyable, relaxing, peaceful places where all distractions are pacified. Relieved of all worries, my mind single-pointed, I will work towards obtaining meditative integration and the taming of the mind. So, you know, relieved of the social life, relieved of the worries in social life, then you can concentrate on meditation. Sensual desires are the progenitor of what is disadvantageous here in this life. Kama. So now he's going to really go off on kama here. Kama, you know, means especially sexual desire. Especially sexual. Sensual desires are the progenitor of all of what is disadvantageous here in this life. Bondage, destruction, and mutilation, as well as in future lives, like being cast into the hell realms. All right, here we go. Other translators of this bit here, and it's a fairly long bit, tend to use the feminine pronoun for who he's going to be talking about. It's actually not in the Sanskrit. It's in the neuter. It's not in masculine or feminine. It's neuter. But he's writing obviously from a male point of view, and so he's going to talk about how off-putting, to put it nicely, how off-putting the body is. The body that you lust after. So here we go. Ready? This is going to maybe destroy the romance of some couples' nights tonight, but anyway. That on account of which you have often sent solicitations by means of male and female envoys, like in Romeo and Juliet, where they send messages to each other through other people. On account of which you never reckoned the cost in bad deeds and disgrace. I think everyone probably knows that when you are in the throes of like real mental affliction, like hardcore versions of mental affliction, you just don't care. You don't care the cost. Right? Throw everything out the window. For which you have been hurled into fear and expended your wealth. Anyone else have this experience of just like, you know, being willing to pay anything for the object of your desire? You know, money, no object. Money is no object. And embracing that which has become your highest nirvana, sex as highest nirvana. They are nothing but bags of bone, disinterested and indifferent. Why do you not go to nirvana, embracing the true object of your desire? See, he's like playing a little bit with the idea that, you know, if you have the notion that your highest, you know, pleasure, highest nirvana is in another person, is in, you know, embracing another person, then well, how come you're not in nirvana? Once you've embraced them. The face is covered by a veil. I think this is a reference to veiling the face of a corpse. Okay? The face is covered by a veil, and you've either seen it before as the veil was raised reluctantly. So this is talking about a bride, and then they raise the veil, you know, kind of shyly and modestly. Or have not seen it as it was kept down bashfully and with modesty. So he's talking about kind of like two different kinds of veiled faces. One that's dead and one that's alive. You see what I mean? Everyone okay with this? The face that now brings you unbearable distress, the dead face. Behold it being revealed by vultures. Why do you flee from it? You were so interested in the veiled face of the bride, and now you're fleeing from the veiled face of the deceased corpse as the vultures try to raise it. Why, O jealous one? So, you know, now it's like, you know, the veil that keeps, you know, your partner from the eyes of other men, right? Why, O jealous one, do you not now guard that which you have shielded from the gaze of others as it is being eaten? seeing this heap of meat being eaten by vultures and others, how can you worship the food of others with garlands, sandalwood, and ornaments? The food of others is the body, right? Human body. You are terrified at the sight of an unmoving skeleton. But why are you not afraid of that which, like a zombie, is still moving? I once had a student in Los Angeles many, many years ago, a relatively young guy, I think he was in his 20s or 30s. And he's saying, you know, he says, I got to talk to you. I've got a big problem. I says, well, what's your problem? He says, oh, I just think about girls all the time. He says, I've got hormones. That's what he put. I'll never forget it. I've got hormones. It's like, you know, I can't help it, you know. And, you know, I gave him this meditation. This is an old meditation. So I said, you know, okay, well, meditate on this. First of all, close your eyes and picture the object of your, you know, desire. He says, yeah, I can do that. I'm picturing all of it. I can do that real easy. He says, okay. So now start thinking about all the stuff that can come out of the orifices. So you start, like, if you got the picture of her, yes, and now watch the earwax start coming out. Now watch the snot come out here, the sleep and the tears come out here, the vomit and the saliva come out here, and down you go. And hold that meditation. Well, it's all in there, isn't it? And it does come out, actually. That's supposed to do it for you. When it comes to being like bothered by lust, you're supposed to do that meditation. So he's kind of doing a version of that. The saliva and excrement, he's really going to go into excrement in a big way here. Okay? Just warning you. The saliva and excrement of these ones comes from the same source, from food. So from food comes excrement. Right? From food comes saliva. Why do you abhor excrement and yet like drinking saliva? What do you suppose he's referring to? Kissing. French kissing, I think, maybe, especially. Those filled with lust do not copulate with pillows filled with cotton and soft to the touch. Because they're nice, they're pure things, they're soft, they're very, very nice. They don't, you know, but maybe there are some people who copulate with them, but, you know, usually you don't. And yet, infatuated with excrement, they do not mind that which emits a foul stench. Why is their passion for that which is covered? And dislike covered, you know, what really is covered by the imagination. What really is kind of his, you know, no holds barred description of the human body. Why is there passion for that which is covered and dislike for that which is uncovered? Uncovered means, well, like when you can't cover it anymore, you know, when the body reveals itself for what it really is, especially at death. If there is no use for that which is uncovered, then why caress that which is covered? If you have no passion for that which is impure, then why do you embrace another who is nothing more than a cage of bones wrapped in sinews and smeared with the slime of flesh? The human body. You have plenty of your own excrement. Be content with that. Lovers of feces, forget about the sack of excrement of another. Saying, I like its flesh. You endeavor to see and touch it. I've used it here. You know, a lot of people translate this as her or she. Yeah. How is it that you want flesh, which is by nature without consciousness? So you say, I like its flesh. You say, well, you know, flesh doesn't have any consciousness. You know, what's so good about flesh? It's just like meat, like hamburger or something like that. That imaginary thing you want cannot be seen or touched. You know, I love you. You know, I love your body, but what I really mean is I love you. But who is the you? An imaginary thing that can't be seen or touched. And that which can be seen or touched is not the experiencer. Why embrace it in vain? So desire is not really for the person. Not really for the flesh, but for the person. But the person here is called imaginary. It can't be touched. It is not surprising that you don't regard this body of another as excrement, but it is amazing that you don't consider your own body as such. Because kind of, we all kind of know about our own bodies, don't we? We kind of, you know, nasty stuff that goes on with our own bodies. It's not surprising that you don't, you know, regard other people's bodies as sacks of shit, but why don't you get it about your own body? The tender lotus born of mud is freed and opens with the sun rays of cloudless skies. So this is something that grows out of the muck. Lotus is a very, you know, often used symbol for something that grows, something beautiful that comes out of something very, you know, awful. But what pleasure is there of in a cage of feces for one whose mind is intoxicated with excrement? If you don't wish to... He goes on like this. When I was translating this, I was telling Cindy, this, how long is he going to do this? It just goes on and on and on and on. If you don't wish to touch the ground or other places where excrement has been smeared, so other places might include a toilet, for example. If you don't wish to touch them, then why do you wish to touch that which has expelled it from the body? You don't want to touch the toilet, but you don't mind touching the thing that brought you what you didn't want to touch in the toilet. If you are not passionate about what is impure, then why do you embrace another who has been born and grown as a seed from a field of excrement? Now he's talking about the mother, you know, and where you came from, you know, what part of the body, you know, you were brought into the world from. You don't fancy an impure worm that has come from excrement because it's so small. But you desire this body also born of excrement and consisting of a lot of excrement. Not only do you not shun your own excrement, you who are insatiable for feces, but you also want the vessels of excrement of others. Kind of is. Even the earth is thought to be impure when what is delicious, like seasoned rice or camphor and the like, is spat out or vomited from the mouth. If you're not inclined to believe the evidence that this body is excrement, then go look at other revolting bodies left in the charnel grounds. Knowing the great terror that comes from having your skin ripped off, how can you take pleasure again in that? So this is actually the long playing version of that same meditation that I gave that kid, you know, many years ago. He's not done yet. The fragrance of sandalwood does not come from anything else. So the fragrance of sandalwood comes from sandalwood, not from something else. Although it is applied to the corpse. So apparently that's a regular thing in India, yeah, putting sandalwood on the corpse so it doesn't smell so bad. Why are you enamored of someone because of the scent that belongs to something else? So here he's kind of like switching back and forth again between corpse that's covered with sandalwood so it doesn't stink and woman covered with perfume so that she doesn't stink. If there's no desire because of what naturally stinks, you know, without deodorant, without perfume, without aftershave, if there's no desire because of what naturally stinks, isn't that a good thing? Isn't it good not to have, you know, he's saying that in its natural state, the body actually isn't desirable. It's got to be dolled up, you know, and covered up. Because the natural smell of the body is not appealing. I thought this was going to be hardcore, right? If there's no desire because of what naturally stinks, is that not a good thing? Why is the world infatuated with what is useless and anointed with fragrance? Did the sweet smell of sandalwood come from the body? It didn't. Why be enamored of someone whose fragrance comes from something else? If it goes on, keeps going. If the naked body, this receptacle of filth, in its natural condition is frightening. Natural condition means if you let it go. Then he kind of describes what it would look like. Hair would grow long, nails would grow long, stained yellow teeth. then why make such efforts to beautify what is like a weapon for the destruction of the self? So the body here is like referred to, especially the attraction to the body, is referred to a weapon that destroys you. The earth is overburdened with the insane who are bent on bewildering the self. You are horrified upon seeing a few skeletons in the charnel grounds, but take delight in the necropolis. You all know what a necropolis is, the city of dead, right? Which is a village swarming with moving skeletons. And yet this excrement is not acquired without payment. So you don't get this sack of shit without like making sacrifices for it. It takes a lot of good karma to get a human body. It takes a lot of good karma to get a human body. To procure it, one makes great efforts and suffers torments in places like the hell realms. It kind of ends up in this like little thing, this long sort of thing about how disgusting the body is, by also pointing out how difficult it is to get a human body, to get a human birth, which is a typical Buddhist teaching. The human birth is the best birth that you could possibly get. So it takes a lot of good karma to get it. But then, and then we get attached to the, the vehicle, get attached to the flesh and bones. And so it goes on into another kind of little thing about attachment. This is a very interesting verse. It was really fun to try to, kind of get this right when I was translating it. A child has no ability to acquire things, right? Because they're too young. You can't get anything. And what can make an adolescent happy? Nothing will make a teenager happy at all. It's kind of like what he's saying. In the pursuit of acquisitions, youth goes by. So in young adulthood, you're so busy working, to try to get acquisitions that you years go by like seconds. What use does an elderly person have with sensual pleasures? Then you get too old to enjoy anything. Some driven by desire are exhausted at the end of the day by their jobs. Driven by desire. I want more. I want more money. I want more things. I want a bigger home. So you work, and then you come home and, drop like a dead person at the end because you're so exhausted. Come home in the evening and collapse as if dead. Others suffer from being away from home on military expeditions. They sign up to join the military in order to make money to send back to the family, or sign up for a job, in Singapore and send it back to Bangladesh or something. Like that, away from home. For years they do not see the sons and wives for which they do it. Bewitched by desire, they sell themselves for that which they do not acquire, and spend their lives uselessly working for others. Then he talks about the wives that they've left behind as they go on these long tours in order to make money. The wives of those left behind who are abandoned the wives of those who always sell themselves and work on commission give birth at the feet of trees in the jungles and other places, which is not a good place to give birth. You'd probably want to give birth in a house, but they don't have enough money to give birth in the house because the husband's away making money, trying to make money to bring back, it's just a nightmare. Fools made contemptible by desire go to war and risk their lives in order to make a living and become slaves for the sake of pride. Some others of those driven by desire are chopped up in pieces or impaled on stakes. You can see them being burned and killed with spears. So here's one of the cash-out verses. Look upon your fortune as an unending misfortune because of the trouble of acquiring and protecting it. I think he's especially talking about, material possessions, of wealth. Look upon your fortune, like fortune in the sense of I have a fortune in the bank. Look upon your fortune as an unending misfortune. Why? Because it takes so much to get it, and then you're worried about keeping it all the time. It's just one big headache. The more you have, the more you have to worry about. The more you want, the more you have to worry about too, because then you're trying to get it all the time. Those with minds attached to wealth have no opportunity for liberation from suffering existence, due to their agitation. This reminds me of a famous verse in the New Testament, in the Bible, where Jesus said, kind of controversially, that it would be easier for a rich man to get in heaven. It would be easier for a camel to get through a eye of a needle. A camel to get through the eye of a needle than a rich man to get to heaven. And so it is that those driven by desire get little gusto. You know that word gusto? Enjoyment. And a lot of distress out of life. Like a beast of burden pulling a cart while grabbing a bite of grass. Trying to get a little bite on the side of the road of grass while it's pulling his heavy weight. For the sake of a tasty bite, which even a beast of burden can easily obtain, the accursed destroys the leisure and fortune so hard to obtain. Which is, you know, kind of the only real purpose of prosperity. The real purpose of prosperity is to allow the opportunity to do something useful with the prosperity, which is to give yourself time to improve yourself. And, of course, it's better to have money than to not have money. But why is it better to have money than to not have money? Is it because you got more boats or more, you know, CD players or something like that, or is it because you potentially have more time? You see, potentially have more time. As long as you're not constantly taking up by trying to get more and keep what you have. And he did a whole bunch of verses on that, about how hard people work all the time to obtain the prosperity, and then they get old and die before they can enjoy the prosperity. Or they get too tired at the end of the day to do anything else but just like fall into bed. I used to work in a suburb of Los Angeles, 50 miles from downtown Los Angeles, this suburb. I mean, Los Angeles it's just a megapolis, huge expansion. People would get up at 4:30 in the morning to make their commute to work in L.A. because, you know, there's so much traffic and all like that. They'd get to work at, I don't know what, 7:30 or 8. They'd work till 5. They'd get back, do a 3-hour commute back to home, get back at 8 o'clock, eat dinner, and go to bed. That's their lives, you know, for at least 5 days a week. And there's many people living like that, many people living some version of that. And, you know, it doesn't have to be a commute necessarily either. Now with the smartphones, you're working all the time, potentially. If the boss can reach you, you are working. You know what I mean? And many people have jobs like this now. Many people just like assume that they should be available for work all the time. And the bosses assume that also, of you, you see. That's just no way to live. The whole concept of leisure time is being eroded. By the smartphone, actually. Single worst enemy. Cindy and I are going to do a teaching when we get back to Singapore in May on getting unbusy. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of debate statistically whether people are working more or not now than they did in the recent past. You know, there's some evidence that people actually are working less, at least in some places. But that just means working, like punching into the job working. It doesn't account for all the hours that you put in after work and on weekends because of the smartphone. So if you factor in the smartphone, people are working way more than they used to work. Way, way more than they used to work. And the whole concept of like having time off is being totally lost. All right. Where are we? And so it is, a little gusto. For the sake of time, you did it. I did that one. 82. I got so much time left. I only have like 6 more verses and it's only like 8:45. You didn't think I could do 88 verses that quickly, did you? Or did you? I didn't think I could do it. This perpetual exertion in trivial matters. In trivial matters, you know, in all matters that you can't take with you. You know, with the money you can't take with you, the home you can't take with you, the gadgets you can't, the possessions, you know, these are all trivial matters. When it, you know, comes to the big picture, when it comes to the big pan out, when you take the big pan out and you see that your life is very, very short, and we'll You know, and of course the other part of the death meditation, death awareness meditation, is not only that death is certain, but the time of death is totally uncertain. So, you know, you like factor, you sort of think, well, I'll work really hard now when I'm, 20, 30, 40, 50, and then I'll have all this time off later. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard about people who, work their whole lives and then they die within like 2 or 3 years of retirement. Many, many people like that, you see. So you can't it's all trivial in relation to death, in relation to the facts of the fact of life, which is death. This perpetual exertion in trivial matters, done for the sake of the body, done for the sake of physical pleasure, done for the sake of sensual pleasure. It kind of all reduces to that. It kind of reduces to the attachment to the body. That's why we work so hard. That's why we want money. That's why we want prosperity and so forth, so that we have, a soft life, so that we have a pleasant, easy life for the body. This perpetual exertion in trivial matters, done for the sake of the body, inevitably is the way to fall into the hell realms and the like, because you haven't paid any attention to anything else, to anything really worth paying attention to. Buddhahood could come about with even a billionth fraction of that exertion. If you think about all the time and effort and sweat and toil and so forth that we put in to making money and to having things and stuff like that, if we put in even a fraction of that kind of effort into a spiritual life, he's saying Buddhahood could come very easily. It's just a matter of priority. Those driven by desire suffer more than the suffering required by the path. Suffering more to work these insane hours and to worry about money all the time and to try and get more and more all the time. More suffering involved than the suffering that comes from trying to overcome anger, for example, or trying to meditate well. But do not achieve awakening. They do all this stuff, but you do not achieve awakening. Recalling the pain of places like the hell realms, no weapon, poison, fire, precipice, or enemy is comparable to desires to calm up, especially sensual desires here. Having thus become apprehensive when it comes to desires, one should generate a fondness for living alone in tranquil wilderness areas, which are free of hassles and troubles. So now he comes back to his theme. Having gone on this long excursion, mostly filled with excrement, he now comes back to the theme of, so now I realize that, wouldn't it be nice to get away from all of that, and to get some solitude, to generate fondness for living alone in tranquil wilderness areas which are free of hassles and troubles. And then he starts, rhapsody. Like a rhapsodizing. He rhapsodizes. In the cool of sandalwood trees and moonbeams, on delightful boulders. I never thought boulders were that delightful, but. Immense as palaces, fanned by quiet and gentle forest breezes, the fortunate ones stroll about and reflect on how to be a benefit to others. So here he's giving a little foretaste of what it is that you should do when you, renounce the world and get serious about a contemplative life. What is it that you should be meditating on? And here it is, on how to be a benefit to others. Wandering wherever and whenever one pleases, living in an empty dwelling, at the foot of a tree or in caves, liberated from the tedium of acquiring and protecting possessions. One lives as one pleases, free from any expectations. Homeless and living as one wishes, dependent on no one, one enjoys the happiness of contentment that even for the king of the gods is so hard to obtain. So that's the first bit. And I like it that he ends there with a reference to contentment. He's really talking about how to live a life where you're not always striving for more, trying to have, you know, good relations with others when there's so much difficulty in, you know, social interactions and stuff like that. How to find contentment. And so for us, I think the trick is going to be how to find contentment in the world, in the midst of, you know, of the world. Because, you know, going on retreat is certainly possible for many, many people, you know. Taking time off is, you know, possible. Going on retreat is possible, but living a kind of a whole life out in the jungle or in an ashram or in a monastic situation is not really realistic. So how can we find that, both that peace of mind, you know, in our world, in our lives, in the daily, you know, kind of hustle and bustle of our lives? How is that going to happen? And so we have to revise it a little bit, you know. Have to think about this. And here he's kind of, you know, he's giving some, I think, a hint at what peace and quiet kind of consists of. It doesn't just consist of, you know, unplugging, which it does, you know, it partly consists of that, of not being bombarded all the time by stimulus. But it also means a kind of a mindset of contentment, a mindset of in which you, you know, aren't constantly desiring. Or the other main mental affliction. The one main mental affliction is desire, the other one is aversion, where you say, I don't want what I have, you know. This, so you can have this kind of discontented, you know, mindset about the life that you're leading also. A discontented mindset in the sense of I want more, or a discontented mindset about what you already have, not wanting something different. You see? So in the yoga text, they talk about two kinds of rogue energies that are running through the prana, that are running through the inner body, the raga and dvesha, right? The left channel and the right channel. Raga means desire, dvesha means aversion or hatred. And then they talk about the purpose of yoga, of getting those rogue energies centered into the central channel, to get them to enter, stay, and dissolve is the phrase, right? And so these are two different forms of discontentment. Raga means I want something I don't have. Dvesha means I don't want something I do have. So if the purpose of yoga, ultimately, is to get those energies, you know, kind of tamed and centered, what would be the result? If the two rogue energies are two forms of discontentment, what would it mean to say that those two rogue energies have been centered? Contentment. Contentment, you see? And contentment means just that. It means not wanting more or less, either one. Not wanting more than you already have, not wanting something out of there. If only I didn't have this, you know, jerk boss at work, then I'd be happy. If only I had more money, I'd be happy. If only I didn't have this brother-in-law, I'd be happy. See? So that's peace of mind. That's shamatha. Shamatha is contentment. Peace of mind, because the opposite of peace of mind is, you know, is always having the mind disturbed by the discontented mental afflictions. All mental afflictions are forms of discontentment. All mental afflictions. So you can think about it that way. You know, I find this chapter to be less about the actual sitting and, you know, practice of formal meditation, and more about how to live a meditative lifestyle, which is actually the only point of meditation anyway. If you're just meditating in the formal way, you know, sitting meditation, if you're just meditating as an escape, then it's just like taking a drug. It's just like going to the bar. It's just like having a, you know, whiskey. It's just a temporary relief, and then, you know, you wake up the next morning, you know, with a hangover. And you go, oh, my non-meditative, you know, life sucks. That's not the point of meditation. The point of meditation is not an escape. The point of meditation is to learn how to live in the world happily, off the cushion, you see. So that's, I think, what he's emphasizing here when he's talking about jhana, he's not really talking about sitting meditation. He's talking about a meditative attitude that carries on 24/7. All right, so every one of these classes has an exercise. I know there's not a whole lot of time between classes, but the exercise for this class is to think about, what it is that you could do in terms of renunciation in your own life, okay? Like, what are your attachments and what kind of renunciation could you get? A little more detachment, at least, from what it is that you're attached to. As a precondition for the perfection of a meditative lifestyle. Yeah. All right, that's the first 88 verses. The date of this text? It's about 700 AD, they say. 700 AD. 8th century. All right, everyone get... Oh, I wanted to encourage that everyone sort of stay quiet from the time that the evening teaching ends and breakfast begins. And, so maybe minimize the... or maybe eliminate the chit-chatting. There's plenty of time during the day to catch up with each other and all of that. And you know, we are on retreat, and it's a rare opportunity to get away for 4 days like this. So try to get a little bit of that kind of quiet peace of mind, you know, between now and at least now and breakfast, okay? All right, see you tomorrow.